You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1975, a black child named Radar Radmanovic is mysteriously born during a blackout to white parents. That begins a story that takes the reader from suburban New Jersey to Arctic Norway and across the globe to the sites of some of the most terrible events of the last quarter of the 20th century, Yugoslavia, Cambodia, the Congo, and also to unknown regions where radio waves and subatomic particles dance to their own design, uniting a time of conflict and art. I Am Radar, Rafe Larson's second novel, is published by Penguin, which got the book after a newsmaking bidding war, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Larson to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
What was the doctor's explanation for Radar's dark skin pigment?
Yeah, that's sort of the preoccupation of the first 100 pages. People are trying to figure out how did this come to be? You know, what was it, the milkman theory or something more cosmic? And so the mother's character, who was the most difficult character to write for me, because she's a good person who ends up doing bad things, which I think most great fiction is preoccupied with. She becomes obsessed with kind of figuring out a diagnosis for her child, as many of us do. You know, we want the naming of the thing.
Well, people are going to blame her also if something did go wrong.
Yes, yeah. I think she, I mean, we all, you know, I'm a recent new parent. We all feel like, are we doing this right, you know? And particularly when there's something sort of as visible as this, I think she seeks out an explanation for her own motherhood in some ways.
But she also develops a strange medical condition at the hospital.
Yeah, yeah, which actually came from my own experience. I was actually mugged in Brooklyn and suffered kind of pretty severe facial fractures. And one of the side after effects was I lost my sense of smell for 2 years, which was sort of subtle but also profound loss, you know, because you don't really appreciate it until it's gone.
Well, it affects your sense of taste and all sorts of other things. You just
We
rely on it so much without thinking about it. And when you think about dogs having, I think, 80% of their brain involved with smell, and that really affects the way they live their lives without any – you didn't have any smell at all?
No. Well, some of her experience was based on me. So I didn't have any smell at all, but then it would come back in waves and everything would smell like chicken noodle soup, but in like a very unpleasant way. And I think the other thing about smell is it's so tied to memory, you know. It's an emotional sense. So I would be overwhelmed with memories I didn't know that I had. You know?
Did you start this book anyway in the 70s because that was a time of a lot of discussion about race in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I think I sort of worked backwards. I didn't begin in 1970. I began in the present, and then the book told me that we really actually had to begin with the child's birth. And so then I started having to – I realized that's a great time actually to set this birth, you know?
And also allowed you to then go forward for the last 25 years of the century where so many terrible things happened. Right. What did you start with in general here? Obviously, you didn't start with the birth. Did
right.
you start with the people who – in the Arctic in Norway?
Well, I actually started with a story about Susan Sontag going to Sarajevo and putting on a production of Waiting for Godot, which was very controversial at the time and sort of remains so. There were some people who said this was the most noble act of humanity, you know, putting on a cultural event. And then some people were like, you know, the nerve to go in there and presume that this kind of, you know, highbrow was what people needed. But I found myself caught in the middle of that, and I was wondering, you know, it goes to the very essential question of what is culture? Is culture necessary? Is it a basic need like food and water? And what is the role of art, particularly during wartime, when our most basic needs are kind of laid most stark? So from that came this strange group that preoccupies a lot of the book, which they go to these war zones and put on these avant-garde performance art about, you know, high concept scientific ideas.
This is a group of Norwegian school teachers who were in prison during World War II and have founded a radical secret society. They steal radioactive material from the Nazi nuclear reactor that luckily never went into effect, and then use it as a to stage experimental art for people suffering during wartime.
Yeah. So they've only done five shows since 1945. So they're
everyone a disaster.
Yeah, everyone a disaster. And their first one, where they stole that radioactive heavy water, was staged on this Arctic island, and it was seen by no one for 40 years until some Russian fishermen stumbled upon that. And I guess that's a question that brings up a question for me: is, you know, what is art require a witness? You know.
The famous koan, if you make a noise in the forest and nobody hears. You've called the book a family drama, even though at times it feels more like science fiction or what Margaret Atwood calls speculative fiction. Does Radar's condition help his parents' marriage or hurt it?
I think it pushes it to the breaking point, particularly when the kind of actions in the book happen and he undergoes a sort of transformation. But ultimately, I mean, I think the trick when you're telling a big story that spans a lot of, you know, places and times is to actually keep your focus quite narrow with the characters. So it is, in many ways, just a story of this boy growing up.
Do you think of it at all as science fiction? Because there's a lot of science in it.
Yeah, and there's some kind of semi-fantastical elements. Mm. When you're writing a story, I don't find genre as helpful because you're actually just trying to tell the story in front of you, you know. I think genre is often placed on a story after the fact, you know.
You include a bibliography at the end. Is that a real bibliography?
Yeah, I've been asked
that. Showing off your research?
No. The final scene in the book sort of is the prequel to that bibliography. And most of those titles are made up. So I spent about 3 months. It's actually very difficult to make a fake bibliography. There's a scene in the book where a woman describes looking at people's bookshelves as this really intimate act of looking into their brain. And so the bibliography is also, it's almost like, you know, an erotic act of peering into someone's mind, you know.
What happens, as you said earlier, is Radar's mother, Charlene, is eager to find out what has led to his rare condition. His father seems to have no interest in finding out. But then she receives a postcard from a physicist puppeteer in Norway who wants to help Radar with a special procedure.
Yeah.
I don't know how much we should give away.
Yeah, there. I don't know. Yeah. I think the problem there is that these people are not medical doctors. They're artists. And so their procedures are, you know, maybe not with the best interests of the child in mind. And so this is how the family gets embroiled in these people. But that's a real turning point in the book because, you know, the father was a really against any sort of intervention with his child. But at the same time, he wants to save the marriage. So
he allows it.
He makes a choice which will sort of haunt him.
The family story is intertwined with stories of a man in Cambodia, two very different brothers in Bosnia, and a literature professor who assembles the largest library in the world in Congo while the country is collapsing around him. Although I don't want to give away too much there either, how they're connected to each other. What led you to include those stories?
As I was writing the book, it began to tell me where it wanted to go. And I was like, oh no, we're going to Cambodia. And I actually had to go to these places and do research, which at times was quite grim. I mean, I found myself sort of on the trail of past genocides, you know. And I got a really interesting perspective in countries' PTSDs, you know, that they all deal with these kind of mass horrific acts quite differently. For instance, in Rwanda, there's a sanctioned narrative of the genocide, and everyone sort of adheres to it. Every town has to have a certain memorial. In Cambodia, you know, quite a contrast, the Khmer Rouge was in power for 20 years afterwards, and there's still this kind of layers of denial of what happened. Only now are they starting to kind of digest that.
But they do have museums with skulls.
They do, but it's for the tourists, really. You know, if you go into these villages, the big man in the village is often a Khmer Rouge, former Khmer Rouge guy, and he's a hero for these people. They've built huts, and, you know, it's... evil is always localized, you know, as is good. You know, whoever is building your house is your hero that day. So it's very complicated for people living in these countries still, you know.
Well, actually, the Khmer Rouge officially, Pol Pot, was overthrown, But the people who took over all had were people who had been in the Khmer Rouge at some point.
And only
that complicates things as well.
Exactly. And only now was there a trial of the people in their, you know, in their 80s now. So, you know, reconciliation is such a tricky concept, you know.
Now, there's a lot of science here. Your previous novel, The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet, is about a 12-year-old boy who wins an award for his scientific research and then hitchhikes across the country to get to the place where he has to give his acceptance speech. But science, obviously, is one of your big interests.
Yeah, I think science and art, there's so much commonality there. The driven by curiosity, the driven by the great unknown. I mean, their methods are at times different, but I feel like great scientists are like great artists. You know, they have a sort of way of peeling back the unknown, and they have a way of describing it. But there's a sort of quest towards understanding why we're here that unites artists and scientists.
This is a very elaborate plot. I'm getting the sense that when you started, you had no idea you were going to have this elaborate plot. Did things just keep on coming into your mind, and you have to decide whether you wanted to include them or not?
Yeah, you're both like a brutal surgeon and also a planter. You know, when you're working, because you always you're creating something, but you always have to know, okay, am I going to cut this? And with this book, I tended to say yes because I wanted to see where it's going. But it's a challenge to contain all of these stories in one book.
You must have been pleased when it wound up creating a bidding war among various publishers.
Yeah, well,
do you ever have to work again?
always have to work. Yeah, there's always another book to be written. I mean, I think I'm always surprised when anyone wants to read my books because I find them. You know, when we talk about ideal readers, I sort of write them for myself, and I think I'm kind of have a strange proclivities. But either I'm a lot less strange, or everyone is as strange as I am.
Well, you've also worked in film, and a film was made of your first novel.
Yeah.
But do you go between the two?
I used to. Yeah, I used to make documentary films, but writing books is so hard that I haven't really been able to to make many films. But I did get to go on the set of the film, which was a very surreal experience, you know.
Well, you write surreal books to some degree.
Yeah, yeah. And I make a Hitchcock like cameo in the movie.
That book was translated into 27 languages, and also was a 2010 Montana Honor book. Won a number of awards. This book right now is getting an awful lot of attention. So has anybody talked about another movie, or is this too complicated for a movie?
Yeah, it's sort of, as it stands, it's sort of unfilmable, but there are little sections of it that I think would make really wonderful movies. You know, I always think short stories make better springboards to movies because there's more to fill in. With a novel, you're always playing catch-up. I mean, how can you fit that in one?
Well, this is a big book. You've got a lot of details here. Rafe Larson's latest book is I Am Radar. It is published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.